Fraser Stoddard and Dutch scientist Bernard Benferringa share the 8 million kroner or $930,000 prize for the design and synthesis of molecular machines, according to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Again, more on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
It is Wednesday, October 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the two major political party candidates for U.S. vice president clash in a televised debate. Portugal's Antonio Guterres is set to become the next Secretary General of the United Nations.
Mr. Guterres has had a lot of popularity among member states, both in the Security Council and outside of it.
And we look at the new HBO series, Westworld. It's all ahead. Republican vice presidential candidate Mike Pence and Democratic candidate Tim Kaine spent Tuesday night attacking the policy proposals of each other's campaigns, as well as the records of their running mates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Here's an excerpt stemming from a question concerning the Clinton Foundation, the organization run by Secretary Clinton and her husband, former President Bill Clinton.
She had a Clinton Foundation accepting contributions from foreign governments.
You are Donald Trump's apprentice. Let me talk about this,
Senator,
issue.
I think I'm still on my time.
Well, I think isn't this a discussion?
This is our open discussion.
Let's talk about the state of the world. Let me interrupt you
and finish my sentence if I can.
A little chaotic sounds there. Well, I'm joined by VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Well, Michael, a lot of people seem to be impressed, no matter what they feel politically, but by the performance of Pence.
Indeed. Mike Pence came off as the cool, calm, and collected debater last night. By contrast, Tim Kaine came off as someone who always wanted to interrupt and really seemed to be amped up to a degree that I've never seen the man before. I cover the Senate, and Tim Kaine has been a senator for the last couple of years. I've spoken with him in the halls literally dozens of times. He is one of the most mild-mannered, accommodating, polite people you will ever meet. Not someone that you would assume would be interrupting his opponent in a debate. I don't know how many times, but it might have been 30, 40, or 50 times. Here's the thing, though. This is a unique debate. This is not one of the three debates between the principals, in other words, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. This is the vice presidential debate, and it has sort of a select audience. People who tune in tend to be the real hardcore partisans, people who may have already made up their minds about how they're going to vote. And so, in essence, the goal for both of them is to ramp up their core supporters. I don't think that either men last night were truly looking to make any converts. Instead, they were trying to amp up their base. And when viewed in that light, I think that the rough and tumble of the debate and the back and forth maybe makes a little bit more sense.
Yes, yes. And I think they wanted to make their running mates, the tops of the tickets, look good,
Indeed, indeed. And now, a lot of the sort of instant polls afterwards and the commentary from the news media seem to be that Mike Pence got the upper hand. And that may well be true. On points, he may have won the debate. I would point out, however, that Tim Kaine very doggedly would not let go of the very many things that Donald Trump has said during the campaign that many people find offensive, whether it's concerning Muslims or Mexicans or Russian President Vladimir Putin. And to the extent that Tim Kaine was able to keep the focus on Donald Trump during the debate, even though his style may have turned some people off, I think that the feeling in the Clinton camp is that that can only be to their benefit when so much time of the debate was devoted to Tim Kaine making charges about Trump and Mike Pence either defending Trump or in many cases choosing not to defend Trump.
Mm-hmm. Like one of the controversies just in recent days has been about Mr. Trump's tax, you know, whether he paid taxes or not, particularly the deduction, the alleged deduction that he took over almost $1 billion back in 1995 for business losses. But, you know, even on that, Kaine called on Trump to release his tax returns, which, of course, Trump has not. Well, but Pence said, well, he's a successful businessman who's created jobs.
Indeed. That was one of the sort of central components of the debate where Tim Kaine time and time and time again went back and back saying Donald Trump needs to fulfill his promise to release his taxes. And of course, Mike Pence said, well, he still has time. He's promised to do so. He still may do so. But in fact, he's under no obligation to do so. And if he did use U.S. tax laws, he did so legally and in a way that any businessman would under the circumstances.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Michael. That's VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Well, also joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure there's been a lot of reaction on social media to this debate.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, as we often see, kind of along partisan lines. So if you're a Trump supporter, you thought Pence won the debate. If you're a Kaine supporter and Hillary Clinton supporter, you thought Kaine won the debate. But it seems that most people, most polls have found a slight edge for Mike Pence, style over substance. He had a kind of a more calm style, at least that's what social media noted. The one thing that social media seized on was the interruptions. Mm-hmm. Tim Kaine interrupting Mike Pence, trying to get his points across, but hammering those points in that he can't endorse and support what his running mate Donald Trump has to say. So a lot of back and forth on that. And then of all the people talking on social media, probably the biggest name was Donald Trump himself, who was live tweeting as his running mate and Tim Kaine were squaring off. So he had a lot to say on Twitter congratulating Mike Pence for, he said, winning the debate. But some interesting opinions and retweeting some of his supporters. So very active on social media as this debate is happening. And then some breaking news trending just now that the UN is in a straw poll announced that Antonio Guterres, the former Portuguese prime minister, will be apparently the next UN Secretary General. So a lot of support and congratulations already pouring in for him, even though this news has just come out. And people trying to figure out who this is. And Portugal, certainly he's well known, but in other parts of the world, less so. So people trying to find out who will be the next UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres.
Yeah, we'll be having more on that just coming up a bit later in the program. Well, thanks so much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. Two police officers are stabbed in Brussels, and the case is being treated as a terrorist attack. The British government plans for immigration curbs, and this prompts clash with business. The IMF says record high debt slows economic growth and worries experts. And the FBI arrests an NSA contractor for allegedly stealing computer codes. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new poll by the Pew Research Center finds most respondents who identify as liberal Democrats have a positive attitude toward climate change scientists and their research, while those who consider themselves conservative Republicans are much more skeptical. Pew reports that about 60% of the liberal respondents say climate change will very likely bring about more droughts, severe storms, harm to animal and plant life, and shoreline damage due to rising sea levels. Only about 20% of the conservatives polled consider the potential harm to be very likely, with half saying that they are either not to or not at all likely to occur. The Pew survey also shows that there is bipartisan support when it comes to having scientists play a role in policy decisions about climate issues and for expanding solar and wind energy production in the United States. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the southeastern United States prepares for Hurricane Matthew. Portugal's former Prime Minister António Guterres has unofficially been selected as the next UN Secretary General. He's expected to be officially endorsed in the coming days. I spoke with VOA's United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir about the selection process.
So the way the process works here is that there are a number of candidates from around the world. They go through an interview process with council members, and this year for the first time with members of the General Assembly, so all the member states have a chance to meet them. And then the Security Council goes into private informal meetings over a period of weeks, and they vote repeatedly on these candidates to see, you know, to gauge their enthusiasm about them. Mm-hmm. And they've done, until today, they had five polls, and Mr. Guterres had been the first-place finisher all five times. So he has been a strong favorite from the beginning of this race in July when they started voting. Today was the sixth straw poll, and it's significant because the five veto-wielding members of the Security Council had different colored ballots today, and those ballots equaled vetoes. So if you voted no and you had a red ballot, then you're effectively knocking someone out of the race, because a veto from a P5 kind of killed a candidacy. And Guterres, the big question was, he's led for five polls. The big question today was, would he escape a veto or would he get one? And he escaped it. And so he has become, by virtue of this and by the 13 votes out of 15 that he got favoring his candidacy, he has become the candidate. And tomorrow, Thursday, the council said that they will come together and in a formal vote, hopefully by acclamation, they will pronounce him their candidate for Secretary General. Mm-hmm. And then it moves to the General Assembly, where they will basically rubber stamp this decision of the Security Council. And Mr. Guterres has had a lot of popularity among member states, both in the Security Council and outside of it. His name, I have heard it consistently from the beginning, you know, last spring when people were entering the race. He has been really one of the top favorites of virtually every diplomat I've spoken to.
Well, he was head of the UN Refugee Agency for 10 years. That must have given him, you know, a great boost, I would think.
Well, you know, if you look at the resumes of the candidates, he was a former prime minister and head of a major UN agency. So was Helen Clark, who was the former New Zealand prime minister and head of the UN Development Program, which has like a $5 billion budget. I mean, a huge agency, one of the biggest at the UN. But she never really made it into the top three. She kind of languished in the middle of the pack through all the polls. So people can have similar resumes, but at the end of the day, some of it comes down to politics. Some of it comes down to, you know, how they feel about you on a personal level. But Mr. Guterres has really kind of charmed the member states from the beginning.
Because I know there was some discussion about appointing or electing a woman to that post.
Well, there was a big push this year by about a third of the member states, a whole campaign called She for SG, and they were really hoping that a woman for the first time might lead the organization. You know, some people said the female candidates that came forward just weren't strong enough. Other people said, oh, it's here we go again, another white European man. So, you know, it just depends who you talk to. But I don't think that I have not heard anyone say that Mr. Guterres is not qualified for this job. And there are many people who feel that if Ban Ki-moon, the current Secretary General, had gone through this process the way it was laid out this year for the first time, which was very transparent, where you had interviews with member states in an open forum, where there was also like a faux debate even, if Ban Ki-moon had gone through this process, he may not have been selected. So I think they were really looking for a strong Secretary General, someone innovative. You know, there are so many problems in the world right now. So they really need a strong Secretary General who can work with member states, particularly with, you know, Russia and the United States.
Yeah, it sounds like Mr. Guterres will have his work set out for him.
Oh, boy, really. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Hurricane Matthew roared past Haiti and Cuba and took aim Wednesday at the Bahamas and possibly the U.S. southeast coast later in the week. The National Hurricane Center in Miami has issued hurricane and tropical storm warnings for southeast Florida, with winds still in excess of 200 kilometers per hour. Officials in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina have declared states of emergency. Sammy Fretwell is a reporter with the Columbia, South Carolina publication, The State. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty residents will use many evacuation routes to move inland.
Lanes will be reversed so that there'll be more lanes leaving the coast than going into the coast to help facilitate movement.
Do you have any anticipation about what the timeline will be for the storm to perhaps make landfall around South Carolina?
The latest forecast track from the Hurricane Center shows it right near the North Carolina-South Carolina border around 2 o'clock Saturday, and it would be moving on up the coast after that.
South Carolina, of course, has many coastal communities.
Yes, South Carolina has three large coastal communities. Charleston, which is the historic city that has been here for over 300 years. It's a tremendous tourist spot, but it's also a big working port, and many, many people live there. Myrtle Beach is a very large tourist resort, as is Hilton Head Island. Myrtle Beach is near the North Carolina end of the state. Hilton Head is down near the Georgia end of the state. It's been a while since we've had a very large hurricane actually hit the state. I guess the last large one was Hurricane Floyd in the late 90s. The one that everybody got any age to them remembers is Hurricane Hugo in 1989. That was a devastating storm that just came right through the middle of the state and ended up hitting Charlotte and North Carolina right in the interior of the state.
Meanwhile, the humanitarian agency World Vision has hundreds of staff members in Haiti, which has been hit by Hurricane Matthew. Drew Clark is a spokesman.
A lot of our staff and a lot of the population in Haiti is based in Port-au-Prince, which has definitely been affected by the storm, but is not close to the eye. And with those staff, yeah, they've been reporting to us that as they emerge from their shelter, what they're seeing is a lot of buildings with corrugated tin roofs that have been thrown off in high winds. They're seeing some collapsing of poles and trees and so on. The concern, of course, is the areas that were hit the hardest. This is in the southwestern tip of Haiti as well as in the northwestern tip. And it will take a little while before we can access those areas. Flash flooding is one of the biggest concerns in a hurricane in terms of loss of life, because flash flooding can suddenly take away buildings and drown people. It can also contribute to landslides, which are a major threat in Haiti because there's a lot of eroded hillsides in Haiti that are very prone to landslides.
Do you anticipate what kind of needs the people in Haiti and in that region will need?
Well, after a severe disaster like this, the focus of the first 24 hours is often on search and rescue operations. People want to know their family and friends are okay. But the focus quickly shifts to basic supply provision for people who have been displaced out of their homes. So that means getting basic items like blankets and tarps to sleep under if they're not able to access shelters, as well as water purification tablets if the water supplies have been compromised, and hygiene kits, cooking kits, just basic items.
That's Drew Clark of World Vision. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new series from HBO Westworld revisits the late Michael Crichton's 1973 film and asks viewers if they could live in a fantasy without consequences, what would they do? International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the new series, which stars Oscar winner Anthony Hopkins, Ed Harris, Thandie Newton, and others in a Wild West theme park where it's hard to tell the robots from the humans.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
You're in my dream. I designed every part of this place. It's not a theme park, but an entire world.
In HBO's new series, Westworld, Anthony Hopkins stars as Dr. Robert Ford, who has created the theme park to help guests live out their Wild West fantasies. Westworld bills itself as totally immersive with no consequences and is peopled by so-called hosts, highly sophisticated artificial intelligence robots who believe themselves to actually be gunfighters, ranchers, cattlemen, and prostitutes. Something starts to go wrong, though, when the hosts diverge from their prescripted behavior and remember some of who they are. It seems Dr. Ford has slipped some code into their programming to make them more lifelike, but it might have given them free will. James Marsden plays Teddy Flood, one of the hosts at Westworld.
And there's no consequences. There's no laws. So you can do whatever you want. So it shows what is revealed about the humans and our desires, and also examining like artificial intelligence and when does life begin and when does it end and when does consciousness begin, when does that end. And so these are the themes that, not to get too heady or pretentious, but these are, you know, sort of the underlying themes of the show. And then you watch it all play out.
Thandie Newton plays Maeve Millay, the local madam. She says the series uses fantasy and the Western theme park to explore issues that are very relevant in our world.
You know, Westworld is a place to go and treat robots that think they're humans like pieces of rancid meat. You know, it's arguable that that happens in the world with sex tourism, sex trafficking. I mean, we have to be frank with ourselves, and it's impossible to do that, it seems, but what we can do are create stories that are really well researched, that have their root in probability about the future that isn't fantasy, and through that we can perhaps rehearse where we would like to find ourselves, you know, in seven generations. So the invitation's open.
Evan Rachel Wood plays Dolores, a rancher's daughter who is involved with Teddy. She says that viewers can look for shocks and surprises. Even the cast didn't know what was going to happen from one episode to the next.
Some incredible characters. I think at the beginning, you know, you really get to know them, you get to know the park, and then it's going to take a plummet into a roller coaster that I don't think anybody's ever really prepared for. I mean, we're on the show and we found out what was going to happen script by script. We didn't know in advance anything. And we were shocked and floored, especially episode 10. So just get ready. It's coming. It's coming.
Westworld also stars Ed Harris in his first major television role as a sadistic repeat guest dressed in all black who seems bent on uncovering what is happening to the hosts. Westworld is written by Oscar nominee Jonathan Nolan, known for the Dark Knight movies and the television show Person of Interest, and his wife Lisa Joy, who's known for Burn Notice and Pushing Daisies. Emmy winner J.J. Abrams is the executive producer. Westworld is available on HBO. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such an individual is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated terrorist list. His assets within U.S. reach are immediately frozen, and he is locked out of the global financial network. no U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. Until late last year, Abdelkadir Mumin was a recruiter and spokesman for Al-Shabaab, itself a designated terrorist organization that operates mostly in Somalia. In October of last year, Mumin defected from Al-Shabaab and set up an ISIL affiliate in Somalia's Puntland semi-autonomous region. About 20 other members of Al-Shabaab followed him. The group is known to kidnap boys between the ages of 10 and 15, indoctrinate them, and force them to participate in fighting. On August 31st, the U.S. Department of State added Abdelkadir Mumin to the designated global terrorist list under Executive Order 13224. By doing so, the United States serves notice to the U.S. public and the international community that Abdelkadir Mumin is actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and effectively lock them out of the global financial system. Global terrorist designations can also assist or